I have been looking over the Irish Examiner today, and the headline is "The Long COVID Clinic is Facing Closure Due to the Lack of State Funding." On Monday morning, I believe, I spoke with Professor Tomás Ryan in regards to long COVID on Kildare Today. And he mentioned Professor Jack Lambert. And he is at this clinic. And he says Jack Lambert has seen about 1,000 patients with people experiencing severe levels of fatigue and cognitive challenges, leaving them unable to focus or work in some cases. He says he doesn't want to quit on this, but I am going to quit. The hospital does need to get funded for services they are providing. I am doing this as a freebie, and I used to have my research staff do this clinic, but there comes a point where it's ludicrous. The clinic has been focusing on patients suffering neurological or cognitive issues linked with the virus. In some cases, Professor Lambert said they're getting patient referrals from hospital listed in the HSE interim model of care for long COVID, as they do not have staff specialising in the area. Now, he has submitted a business plan to the HSE and earlier this month raised concerns with the current Health Minister, Stephen Donnelly. Now, a response from Stephen Donnelly's office did say, direct quote, "The HSE's funding for 2023 has not yet been allocated. Therefore, the level of funding available for long COVID has not been determined. Proposals in relation to long COVID and the associated funding requirements will be considered by the department as part of the annual estimates process in the coming weeks." And Jack Lambert is critical of the continued focus on funding lung care. He said he was in his clinic last Friday afternoon. He saw 27 patients. One of them needed some pulmonary assessment. He says, "My hope for these patients is to get a service now." So that clinic is going to close due to the lack of state funding. And many people would say, long COVID, is that something to worry about? Of course, we don't want you to worry about it, but we want the residents and the citizens of this country to be as safe as possible. And it is something that you can get if you do contract COVID-19. And there's a story this afternoon in the Irish Independent relating to a 19-year-old footballer over at Shamrock Rovers. Stephen Bradley is speaking on this one.
Yeah, and Daniel McDonald has it in the Irish Independent today, and it's a preview, obviously, ahead of the Shamrock Rovers and Ferencváros game in the Europa League tomorrow. But the club revealing that one of the players, Conan Noonan, who's 19 and made his first team Rovers debut last summer, involved in pre-season this term before dropping off the radar, has done so because he contracted COVID twice and has struggled with his cardiovascular health since a second bout of COVID and is currently not allowed to train. And medics are trying to get to the bottom of an issue that has kept Noonan off the scene since the spring. Quoted here in the Irish Independent, manager Stephen Bradley says, "I'm a bit gutted about Conan Noonan, to be honest. He would have played a big part for us this year, but he hasn't been able to train for about 4 or 5 months. After COVID, he had problems with his heart, irregular heartbeats, getting dizzy, etc. He's not allowed to train with us at the moment. Basically, he's walking and getting checked by the doc every second week." And obviously, Stephen Bradley talking about how tough it has been for Noonan. He goes on to say, "Yeah, he's such a good kid, someone we felt this year he could make a real contribution, who I felt could have been the standout young player in the country. He has that much ability. It's just really frustrating that he hasn't been able to show that."
Okay, great. Thank you, Owen. So that's the update there in terms of the long COVID clinic that is facing closure. As Professor Tomás Ryan spoke to us on Kildare Today on Monday morning, he mentioned Professor Lambert has been working there, and now Owen mentioning that 19-year-old Conan, who is playing with Shamrock Rovers. In terms of the census, we're getting more and more information over the past few weeks about what we're looking at in terms of our population. And Ireland had its largest population increase since 2008 in the past year. Any links between 2008 and now? You know, recession. I don't know if you could call it. Well, we're not currently in a recession, but there are some links. And the largest population increase has happened. Immigration in Ireland has reached a 15-year high also. Here is reporter Barry White. He has more details on the CSO stats.
The CSO's population and migration estimates for the year to April 2022 show the number of people emigrating rose to its highest level since 2007. With almost 60,000 people leaving Ireland. This included 27,600 Irish nationals emigrating. The figures for immigration into Ireland stood at 120,000 in the year to April, including 28,900 returning Irish nationals and 24,300 other EU nationals. This figure also included 28,000 Ukrainians. Meanwhile, the CSO's data also shows the Irish population continues to age, with almost 770,000 persons living in Ireland aged 65 and over. That's an increase of 22% since 2016.
So keeping you up to date there on the CSO stats. The VAT on defibrillators is a tax on saving lives and must be scrapped. The Irish Heart Foundation insisted in its pre-budget submission. And on the line, I'm joined now by the resuscitation manager with the Irish Heart Foundation. That is Bridget Sinnott. Good afternoon to you, Bridget.
Hi, Ciara. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. I just want to note before we actually get into this conversation that we have had our listener here at the station, Brendan from Talla, get in contact with us a few times when we spoke about, you know, defibrillators and I guess, you know, the topic in general. And he has noted how it saved his life. It has saved so many people's lives across this country. And it seems common sense that the removal of VAT would help more people to get, you know, have their lives saved.
Well, that's exactly it. I mean, anything that makes defibrillators cheaper makes sense. And I suppose the more that we have in areas, the better. I suppose where we're coming from it is that if you buy your AED, there's another 23% VAT added on to it. And in lots of cases, it's maybe a GAA club or a voluntary group, or it's a community group that decide that they're going to put an AED in their village or town or wherever. And so they go and they fundraise their hard-earned money. And then on top of what it costs to buy the AED, it's a further 23%. And also every time that they have to replace the pads or the batteries, there's a further 23% VAT on that as well. So, you know, you're adding on at least, like if you were buying a 1,000 euro AED, it's costing you another 230 euro in VAT. And, you know, like, I mean, it's something that shouldn't have an extra tax on. It's making them cheaper, the government should be doing. So now the opportunity has come up where this VAT can be removed from certain products, and AEDs would be one of the products that they can be removed from, because there was a tie-in in Europe and it couldn't happen. So this now is the time that we need to be shouting and getting this back removed.
And Bridget, give me a bit more details in terms of the AEDs. How does one choose what to purchase? Because you're mentioning one would say around 1,000 euro would have VAT of, would say, around 200 euro. If you're looking at one that's 1,500 euro, the VAT would be around 340 euro and so on, so on. What are the differences in terms of the prices of these AEDs?
You're just better at maths than I am, Ciara, to be honest with you. I just picked a 1,000 euro because it's easier to work out the VAT.
Okay.
Like the thing with AEDs is I always advise people, there are several different makes and models out there. And when you're going buying an AED, sometimes it's not the cheapest one at the time of purchase that is the best, because if you work it out over a 10-year period, you know, pads and batteries, it could work out as the same price as a more expensive one. So like when you're looking at it, the things that you need to look at is how long will the batteries last? How long will the pads last for? They're all similar anyway. Just, you know, are they nice and sturdy? If it was dropped, you know, there's all sorts of things that we would ask people to look at. You know, are they going to be inside? Are they going to be outside? I suppose my big message on AEDs is if you're buying an AED, make it 24-hour accessible. That's the big thing, because there's no point in buying an AED and locking it into a cabinet where people only have certain access to it. So our thing is, you know, open them up, get them out there, have them accessible to people. But like, you know, as I said, Ciara, there are so many makes and models now at this stage that it really depends. Some people will ring up some companies, they'll get on better with some salespeople or whatever, and they'll buy their AED. You know, like a shock is a shock. Yes, there are, obviously there's some intricacies in AEDs, and, you know, if they can analyse the rhythm quickly and if they can deliver the shock quickly, the less time that the hands are off the chest, those are the ones to look at. But I don't want to complicate it for people. I'm kind of saying, you know, get your AED and that's it. But prices is not an indicator.
And Bridget, you're mentioning, you know, to have them accessible 24/7, and a lot of places across the country they are. And I don't want to, you know, just focus on this, but it is something that I think needs to be asked. Unfortunately, some of these AEDs can be damaged, you know, due to different situations, including antisocial behaviour. If your AED is damaged, does that mean you have to go out and spend another, you know, 1500 euro or whatever it may be? Is there the possibility of repairing them? Because we obviously want them to be accessible 24/7, but it can lead to potential issues.
It can, yeah. And I know, I understand exactly what you're saying. It depends on the damage, again, Ciara, that happens to it. If someone pulls out the pads and they don't damage the rest of the AED, you know, like, then it's a set of pads. But, like, I mean, we don't want people tampering with AEDs. Like, I suppose we need to get that message out there as well to young people, to older people, whoever it is that feels that they should damage these AEDs. It's a whole education piece, really. The potential there to save a life. And if that AED has been damaged, well, then someone's life may not be saved. And I suppose if we get the message through to people, it could be one of your own family members whose life is not saved because you tampered with the AED. You know, they're pretty sturdy, but they shouldn't be taken out and roughed around. And they do need to be stored properly in properly heat-controlled cabinets, you know, so they are a medical device and they need to be treated with respect. But, you know, I suppose, like, to all of the listeners, you know, educate younger people. I'm not saying that it's all younger people that are damaging AEDs either. Educate everybody about the importance of these AEDs and how we need to have them there. And we need to get rid of the fear as well about these AEDs not being accessible. We do need them accessible. There's nothing as bad as a cardiac arrest happening and nobody having access to the AED.
Absolutely.
Like, sometimes there are locks on them where you have to get a key from people.
I've seen that a lot, actually, yeah.
Yeah, and, like, you know, like, in the event of an emergency, like, a statistic for everybody to remember is that for every minute without CPR or defibrillation, your chances of survival decrease by 10% per minute. So if you're going to be faffing around trying to open cabinets or find keys or ring whoever has the key, like, minutes are passing by, and each minute, like, is, you know, it's just so important. I can't stress it enough. You know, it's so important to have access there all the time.
Okay, well, listen, just getting that message out there again. Thank you so much for joining me. That is Bridget Sinnott, Resuscitation Manager at the Irish Heart Foundation. And the Irish Heart Foundation have released their pre-budget submission. If you want to take a read of the whole thing, head on to the Irish Heart Foundation's website. But they're calling for the VAT. This is one of the main things in the pre-budget submission, to be scrapped on defibrillators. As I was saying, would say a defibrillator worth 1,500 euro, the VAT on that would be around 340 euro. And Brendan, I was mentioning, has been in touch with us. He's over in Tala. Good afternoon to you, Brendan. And he says, Ciara, I'm tuned in. Thanks for the mention, Brendan, because Brendan has told us so many times how that saved his life, an AED, and he's, you know, just showed us how grateful he is. And again, it's the message that has been echoed by Bridget there. Thanks for being in touch, Brendan. Now, a new survey has been carried out by Sims IVF, and it highlights the pressure that young people feel to reach certain milestones in their lives. I'm joined now by Group Patient Services and Operations Manager at Sims IVF. That's Kathleen Chatty. You're very welcome to the show this afternoon.
Thanks, Ciara.
So this is something I think anybody of any age can relate to. This is in particular highlighting the pressures under 45s feel. But we're always comparing ourselves to others and, I guess, seeing if we're at the right, in quotes, stage of life.
Absolutely. And I suppose what the survey highlights is the impact that fertility or fertility issues can have on both men and women, but on couples, and it doesn't really matter what age they are. I think what's come out from the survey, that there's been surprises all the way through, really, when we putting the data together. I suppose it's obvious that it would be the 25 to 34, we'll say, age groups that are maybe affected. But the 35 to 44 are affected in a different way.
Yeah.
But I think what I suppose we wanted to highlight with the survey itself is the need for support.
Yeah,
you know,
I mean, if
family and friends.
If
yeah.
we focus on the biological basics,
yeah.
you know, women unfortunately do only have a certain time period
yeah.
to carry their own child as safely as possible, I guess you'd word yeah. it as. But nowadays we know we're doing things later. Firstly, we're living longer, so it
yeah.
means we have more time to do things that we might want to do. People feel like they need to get themselves set up career-wise, have their finances set up, you know, absolutely perfectly. They need to make sure that their job is at the best place it could possibly be. They've got the house. All these things that at the moment can feel out of reach for many people who are on average or above average and way above average salaries. So unfortunately, the starting of families can be put to the back burner, and then a lot of stress can come in the next couple of years because one feels like they had to do that.
Absolutely. And we know, and I mean, I've been working in the fertility field for 24 years now. And the reality is age is one of the biggest stumbling blocks that is out there. It's the one thing that, you know, that science can't overcome in many ways. There's an awful lot of things that can be done now. But that simply is something that we can't overcome. We do it with things like egg donation, sperm donation, but that's only a small, tiny proportion of the issue. I mean, I suppose we've talked about it before, whether, you know, this is something that needs to be discussed in schools. Does
yeah.
it need to be discussed in secondary schools?
Because I'm sure a lot of children nowadays may have, you know, come
it.
From IVF, if
yeah.
that's the right way to word it.
Yeah.
And their parents would have used that to obviously
yeah.
conceive them. You're mentioning, though, there, you know, the donor eggs and the donor sperm.
Yeah.
In terms of biologically, you know, yourself and your partner, if it is a male-female partnership deciding to have a child and using IVF, if you look at the age brackets, right, in terms of this survey, 25 to 34 year olds, they felt more pressured in terms of looking at the milestones others are hitting compared to those in the 35 to 44 age bracket. They feel most pressured though around having their first child and buying a home as well as getting married, having a second child or advancing in their career. So in terms of the percentages that come into you at Sims IVF, is it, you know, you reach a certain age before you can possibly freeze eggs especially?
And that's part of the difficulty. We know that if you're looking at freezing eggs, for example, you need to be really doing it under 35, and that's going to give the best chance. But the reality is most women, if you like, are going to be thinking about it as they reach their sort of 35, 36 age bracket. And I've always hated calling it the biological clock, but that is what it is. Before you start thinking about the possibility of having a family. And if you're not in a relationship or you haven't got a partner, or you're in a same-sex relationship and you need to be, you know, thinking of something like of sperm donation, then you've got to think, you've got to think ahead. And you're thinking at that stage, what do I do? What are my options? And at that stage, you're probably thinking about it at 37, 38 age bracket. And at that point, you know, your chances, your own fertility is declining at that stage. You know, we're meant to be having biologically our families and our children historically in our 20s, if you like. That's the way the body was mm-hmm. to a certain extent built. But that's, and this is part of the problem. Even us having this discussion puts certain pressures on people to a certain extent.
Yeah.
Because you know, some of your listeners out there will be mothers or fathers or sisters or friends. And, you know, you're thinking, oh, you're getting to 32, 33, you should be thinking about it. That's a very personal observation, if you like, for anybody to make to somebody else. And that can be very hurtful because you don't know what a couple or a woman is going through.
Mm.
Are they already on the fertility journey and just haven't shared it with anybody? Because a lot of people still choose not to discuss it. And you don't know at what point. We don't know with couples, they may have achieved pregnancy but had a miscarriage. and not shared that with others. So you don't ever know what anybody or any couples are going through. I'm in my 50s now. I would have been as guilty as any in the past of, you know, friends getting married, and you do ask the question, you know, when the baby's coming along now, or you just had the one and you're barely out of hospital and you're talking about, you know, number two. But the pressure that, you know, I've changed my modus in that respect. Yeah. I'm happy to discuss it, and all, you know, my friends and family know I'm more than happy to discuss fertility issues if that's what somebody wants to do. But I leave it for them to come to me. I don't ask the question, because you simply do not know where anybody is at. And all you can do, if you do know, is offer the support. Offer to be that ear, but, you know, be very clear and look, I won't ask you, but you'll know you can come and talk to me anytime is always a good way of doing it.
I think the truth of all these conversations in terms of, you know, comparison, no matter what that comparison is in your life, whether it's, you know, trying to conceive, it kind of starts from, would say, childhood within our society, because we all do the same thing for, would say, you know, by and large, most people nowadays go to third level. So you're all doing the same thing until about 25. So you're like, oh, Johnny and Mary are doing the exact same thing as me. I'm grand. Like, this is what I'm supposed to be doing right now. And then, you know, as we grow older, things become more complex. You're doing different things. But as we started as a human, it was normal, and it should be the way that everybody's doing the same thing you are.
Yeah. And again, we talk often about, you know, all the confirmations, the communion confirmations, the 18th, 21st all come together, then the weddings come together. How many times do you hear of, you know, people in their 20s talking about, oh, I have another wedding?
Totally,
And there's a presumption then that babies are the next. Some couples don't want to have children. Some women choose not to have children. Some, you know, so there's a lot of different reasons. But society, I think, puts pressure. And sometimes we put pressure on ourselves as well, you know. And the problem with something like fertility is, because we know it declines when you hit the 35 age bracket, which is still relatively young, you know, and it's going down. We you know, you're under a time pressure then. And you don't have the luxury of waiting necessarily. I mean, one of the things I've always found interesting is we have a fertility awareness week every year in July, and over the years we've you know had offers and we've had sort of drives where, you know, the option to come in and check your AMH level, which is one of the blood tests that we do to check ovarian reserve. I mean, we're you know, you're talking probably around 800 to 1,000 women coming through for that every year. It's phenomenal. But that's because people, you know, we are interested. And unfortunately, you know, some GPs are fantastic if you're concerned or worried. But if you're not in a position where you can think about having a child, you kind of feel a bit silly going to your GP to say, I want to check my ovarian reserve. I want to check and see how fertile I am.
You feel like you're wasting or backing up the system. Listen, it was really, really lovely speaking to you this afternoon. That is Kathleen Chadha. She is Group Patient Services and Operations Manager at Sims IVF. And the new survey there revealing pressure. The under 45s feel to reach certain milestones in their lives, particularly those aged between 35 and 44. They feel less pressure, believe it or not, compared to those 25 to 34. I'm sure that has something to do with growing up with social media as well. Who knows? Bringing you more stats from that survey. This said, or it revealed here, out of the 400 respondents under the age of 45, 60% of people felt under pressure or do feel under pressure from family and friends to reach certain milestones in life. 53% said they were feeling under pressure to start a family. Over three quarters believe that friends and family members can ask too many intrusive questions around family planning in general. And 17% of those surveyed reported societal pressure to buy their first home. And it's noted with the current housing crisis, some reported wanting to put off having children until they have a house, which you could completely understand. We're speaking to Cathal Berry on Kildare Today this morning, and there are a meeting of 8 independent TDs meeting with the Minister for Expenditure, Michael McGrath, this afternoon. It's the Regional Independence Group, and they are calling this afternoon for 0% interest loans to help people improve their home energy ratings. It's one of the proposals they're bringing. Excuse me, it's a group of 9 TDs, including Cathal Berry as the 9th TD. And it comes ahead, as we know, of next month's budget. The first time we will see the budget in 2020, in September. It's not 2022, in September. We're speaking about long COVID and COVID-19 at the beginning of the show, and Norma has been in touch. She says, "Hi, Kira, I'm immunocompromised and I'm receiving my last vaccination next week, and that will be my 4th. Because Hazel was asking earlier about, you know, those with long COVID, do we know or do we have the stats available as to how many vaccines they had received when they were diagnosed with the condition? Which would be very interesting to get more information on, Hazel." But Norma points out there, she's immunocompromised and she's going to have her 4th vaccine next week. I know people who are immunocompromised, they had their 1 and 2 vaccines, would say, to be fully vaccinated, if they got the Pfizer or Moderna or whatever it was. Then they got an additional dose, it's what it's called. And then they received a 4th vaccine, which technically was their booster. And now they're entitled to a 5th vaccine. So I wonder, did you do that, Norma? Or did you get offered the additional dose? Because I do know of people personally who would have gotten that, the additional dose, then the booster, and now they're on to their 2nd booster. But of course, thank you for getting in touch. If you can give me those details, they are very welcome. So it's that time of year again, BT Young Scientist. For me, that is when I know everybody's going back to school. I used to kind of dread this time of year when I was younger because, yeah, it was one summer. But those students in County Kildare, they have been encouraged to get their thinking caps on as the entry deadline does near. It's the end of September. The 26th of September is when you have to get your entries in by. And Mary Cahalan, who's been on this show many times before, is the head of the BT Young Scientist and Technology Exhibition. She joins me now. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you. And I have the same dread that you do, Kira, when it comes to this time of year.
Really? Were you that kid that was like, please, not summer over?
Well, when I was going to school, you never went back until sort of the end of the first week in September. So you always had a little bit more time.
So it seems to be
earlier and earlier.
Yeah, it's definitely earlier. I'm trying to think. I kind of went, yeah, I'd go like around the 1st of September, maybe. The primary school, secondary school, I had to go back in August, which was pretty difficult. But I have to say, when you're in secondary school, one of the best parts of it is the BT Young Scientists exhibition. And it's happening again, of course. It has, Sean, as it's put here, a spotlight on STEM research and innovation over the past 60 years, which is amazing. But this year it's returning as an in-person event for the first time, of course, since the pandemic was declared. So lots of reasons to celebrate, Mary.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We're delighted that we'll be able to get to meet the students, judges and general public face to face for the first time in 2 years. Little did we know when we closed the doors in 2020 that we would be doing 2 virtual events, which thankfully were very, very successful. And we had lots of entries and lots of brilliant ideas. But it's going to be great. And really rewarding to have it back in person again.
Okay, I need to ask you about ideas, because that's one of my biggest problems in life, is trying to decide on something. And I'm sure a lot of students out there are thinking the same. Oh, I've got this idea, I've got that idea. What would you advise them?
Right, number one, as you said, the most important thing is the idea. I've been involved in the BT Young Scientists for over 20 years. So what I have seen is, if a student picks a topic that they're really passionate about or they really want to know more about and they're not going to get bored researching, they'll actually have a ball and they'll really enjoy their research. So make it something personal, make it something that you're passionate about, something that you want to learn more about. And I think that's a winning formula, really.
And of course, you know, so many people who've won the BT Young Scientist and Technology Exhibition or just been involved have gone on to do incredible things later in their life. And when I say later in their life, it might only be 5 years later or 1 year later. They all seem to be just such incredible people. And of course, if you do enter, you could possibly be winning €7,500 this year, which is absolutely amazing to be a student and winning that kind of money. But you go on to represent the country. That is at the European Union Contest for Young Scientists, where Ireland has a very strong history, Mary, of taking home first place.
Yes, the competition has gone through what they call editions, 32 editions, and Ireland have been placed first 16 times.
So I mean, that's like the Eurovision. We're just like nailing it every time.
Yeah, but it's been a while now since we've done well in the Eurovision. So at least we're doing well in one European competition.
Yeah, that's
true. I tried the athletics of last week as well, which was absolutely brilliant. But
Are we not still number one with the Eurovision?
I think
we still are.
We might be, but yeah.
And, well,
probably.
This is much more impressive. This is a 50% win ratio.
In terms
of the young scientists. Ireland has won 16 times out of 32 editions. That is really, really incredible. Listen, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon. Always lovely to speak with you. That is Mary Callan. She is the head of the BT Young Scientist and Technology Exhibition. She's on to remind people the project deadline for the exhibition 2023. It is approaching very quickly. Students from across this county encouraged to get your thinking caps on, turn those creative ideas into project entries. The date to get your entries in by the 26th of September.